this hour's top stories. Iran fires multiple new generation ballistic missiles and operates offensive drones during a major military drill. U.S. authorities say President Trump supporters who stormed the Capitol last week intended to capture and assassinate elected officials. Also in headlines, official figures show the UK economy shrank by 2.6% in November due to fresh restrictions imposed to stem the coronavirus. Welcome to the program. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has launched major military exercises in the central desert of the country. The first stage of the maneuvers kicked off with firing ballistic surface-to-surface missiles and operating bomber drones. The new ballistic missiles are equipped with detachable warheads. That gives them guidance from outer space and enables the missiles to penetrate the enemy's missile shield. The exercises have been held in the presence of IRGC Commander-in-Chief Major General Hossein Salami and other senior military officials. The U.S. has rejected a plea by U.N. officials to reverse a decision to declare Yemen's Ansarullah movement a terrorist group. The U.S. Deputy Ambassador to the U.N. said the designation would help move forward the political process to settle the Yemen conflict. Richard Mills was addressing a U.N. Security Council briefing that saw fierce criticism of the U.S. decision. On Sunday, Washington blacklisted the Ansarullah movement, which controls northern Yemen. U.N. officials have opposed its designation, citing humanitarian impact and dire consequences for the peace process in Yemen.
I am extremely concerned about the impact of the decision from the United States to designate Ansarullah as a foreign terrorist organization. We fear, in my mission, that there will be inevitably a chilling effect on my efforts to bring the parties together.
We are struggling now without the designation. With the designation, it's going to be catastrophic. It literally is going to be a death sentence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of innocent people in Yemen.
UN Humanitarian Chief Mark Lowcock also urged Washington to reverse its decision. He said Ansarullah's designation could cause a famine not seen in the past four decades. The European Union has also criticized the U.S., saying the designation could hinder aid deliveries to Yemen. The country has been devastated by the Saudi-led war that began in 2015. The UN has described Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Ansarullah and its allied army units are fighting Riyadh that is backed by Washington. International lawyer Mr. Edward Corrigan says the U.S. decision to blacklist Ansarullah would be another disaster for millions of people in Yemen.
A lot of commentators look at the Hutus, and they're based in Sana'a, as the real government, and then the Saudis and UAE and their allies are in the south, with their fracture too. The Saudis support one faction, the UAE supports another faction. There is Al-Qaeda elements. There are, people that are tied with the Yemeni government, but that's a confusing mess. But this is clearly a disaster to say that they're a terrorist group and then to impose all sorts of sanctions. The European Union, European countries are opposed to this. You also have the United Nations speaking out strongly against it. Again, it's the poor people of Yemen. They're going to suffer the consequences. They're going to be starved into submission. The only tool the Trump administration has is a sledgehammer, and they just want to smash their opponents.
The Yemeni port of Hodeidah has been forcibly closed by the Saudi-led coalition since the start of the war on Yemen. The closure has caused thousands of workers to lose their jobs and their source of income, further exacerbating Yemeni's suffering. Our correspondent in Hodeidah, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has more.
The port of Hodeidah, which is the only outlet to the outside world for millions of Yemenis, is still suffering from a forced closure imposed by the Saudi-led coalition. This has caused thousands of workers to lose their jobs, increasing the rate of poverty and unemployment in the coastal governorate.
The workers at the port of Hodeidah include 3,500 workers in the port and 500 others in other fields of the port. They support a family, and the closure of the port has eliminated the source of income of these people. The suspension of operations of the port has affected the lives of all Yemenis who depend on the port for the arrival of food and medicine.
This port is the only outlet for millions of Yemenis to receive essential supplies, and its continued closure means they can't easily have access to adequate food and medicine, not to mention the large economic losses for the Yemeni economy, estimated at over $1 billion.
The port of Hodeidah is one of the important ports in the Red Sea, and direct and indirect corporate losses are estimated at $1.24 billion in total. This is a large sum, since the Red Sea Ports Corporation is responsible for 70% of the imports sent to the 20 governorates for more than 20 million Yemenis.
Yemen has been suffering from a sea and air blockade since the Saudi-led coalition launched its war in March 2015, which has destroyed the country's infrastructure, killed tens of thousands of civilians and starved millions of women and children. As the Saudi war on Yemen approaches its seventh year, Yemeni calls for the demilitarization of Port of Hodeidah continue to be ignored by the United Nations and other relevant international organizations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali from Port of Hodeidah.
Well, it was November 2020 when the U.S. Acting Defense Secretary Chris Miller announced that the country would slash its troop levels to 2,500 in both Iraq and Afghanistan in the following year. The withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan has already been welcomed by top Afghan officials. They say the absence of foreign troops will not adversely affect the Afghan military. More in this report.
On October 7, 2001, the U.S. and British forces attacked Afghanistan. Later in November that year, there were 1,300 American troops in the country. They were increased to 100,000 in 2010. Anti-U.S. sentiments had increased among Afghans, mainly due to its failures in protecting civilians as well as in uprooting terrorism and narcotics production.
The Afghan government says international assistance to Afghan army will continue in 2021 amid the U.S. withdrawal and controversial peace talks between Kabul and the Taliban. However, some top officials here say Kabul is militarily capable of coping with any emergency situation.
Addressing a recent meeting in the Afghan Defense Ministry, President Ghani emphasized that the National Army is the symbol of the country's pride and that nothing will stop it from serving the country and the nation despite a possible reduction of foreign support.
I have repeatedly said, and I'm saying now, that we will not build roads in case of emergency situations, but the Afghan army will be fully active under any circumstances.
Top military officials in Kabul believe the withdrawal of foreign troops from Afghanistan will not create an opportunity for terrorists to win the war.
The potential withdrawal of foreign forces is not a matter of concern for us, because 96% of operations are being conducted independently by our own forces. We receive aerial support from our international allies for the remaining 4%. It means that we are not concerned about the withdrawal of foreign forces.
Adding to the uncertainty surrounding the withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan, U.S. President-elect Joe Biden, who will take office on January 20th, is still to announce the official stance of his administration on U.S. Taliban deal that was inked back in February 2020. As official statistics show, America's longest war in Afghanistan has so far claimed the lives of over 4,000 U.S. troops, tens of thousands of Afghan military forces, and over 50,000 civilians. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
U.S. federal prosecutors say President Trump's supporters who stormed Capitol Hill last week intended to capture and assassinate elected officials. Prosecutors offered that view in a filing asking a judge to detain Jacob Chansley. He is the QAnon conspiracy theorist who stood at the desk of Vice President Mike Pence in the Senate. Mike Pence, well, according to the detention memo, Chansley left a threatening note for Mr. Pence. The prosecutors say Chansley's words and actions are part of evidence showing the intention of the attackers. Trump supporters breached the Capitol during its meeting to certify Joe Biden's win in the November presidential election. Five people were killed as a result. The U.S. Justice Department has brought over 80 criminal cases in connection with the violence. The United States is beefing up security measures in the capital, Washington, and states across the country ahead of Joe Biden's presidential inauguration on January the 20th. 20,000 National Guards were deployed to Washington after the FBI warned of a major security threat. For more on that, we were joined by our guests in our news review program. Take a look, please.
The capital of the U.S. is beefing up security ahead of the presidential inauguration of Joe Biden. City center of Washington, D.C. is under lockdown with more than 20,000 armed National Guards deployed. Washington Police Chief Robert Conti said U.S. Capitol is facing a major security threat 1 week after supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump stormed the Capitol. State Capitol buildings across the country are also on high alert after the FBI warned earlier this week of armed protests being planned in Washington and all 50 U.S. states. Heavy security measures will run until Biden's inauguration ceremony slated for January 20th. And joining us now for this news review is Wilmer Leone, columnist and political scientist, joining us from Washington, D.C. Hello, Wilmer. Pleasure to have you on. Happy New Year. Hope you're doing safe and you're well. We've seen some really unprecedented things in the last week or so in the U.S. Your thoughts on security when it comes to Joe Biden's inauguration in less than a week?
Oh, at this stage of the process, I don't really think that security is going to be an issue. We don't know what the protesters, the insurgents, the insurrectionists have planned, but I think things now have gotten to the point where the government's ready for whatever they've got.
And the siege last Wednesday on Capitol Hill, you know, there are certain news outlets that are saying that there is proof that they were planned, that it wasn't just, you know, people just converging on the Capitol, irate, feeling their vote was stolen, you know, stuff that was kind of like they got riled up by U.S. President Donald Trump, but that there was people with floor plans, with, you know, an exact agenda, and they were coordinated, and perhaps they were even coordinated, you know, via social media or their phones or whatnot to do exactly what they did and perhaps even more, and they fell short of actually possibly killing people in that building. So do you feel that there is going to be another coordinated effort to disrupt the inauguration? Or meanwhile, supposedly there's 50 different states now worried that their capitals are going to see similar protests on inauguration day. Your concerns?
This was definitely an inside job. There's no question about that. The United States Capitol is one of, if not the most secure buildings in the world. And you don't just breach that fortress without, you don't just breach that fortress without air cover and an army. They were let in. They knew where they were going. They knew who they were looking for. They knew where those people were supposed to be. This was definitely an inside job, and the FBI has information to support that position. So I worked in the building, so I'm quite familiar with how secure the building is. And you don't get into through those doors unchallenged and without rounds being fired. So this was definitely an inside job. There's definitely going to be a very huge lift needed by the state houses in the 50 states across the country. It's not going to be pretty, but I don't think we're going to see another January 6th on the 20th of January.
All right, good stuff. Very optimistic there. And now we're joined by Matthew Fogg, former Chief Deputy for the U.S. Marshals Service, joining us also from Washington, D.C. Hello, Marshal Fogg. Happy New Year. Hope you have a great 2021, you and your family. Now, Marshal, I have to ask you this question. How concerned are you that, you know, we're going to lead up to this in less than a week's time, Joe Biden's inauguration? Do you feel it's going to be a heavy burden, and do you feel U.S. law enforcement will be overwhelmed to provide security in the next week or so?
Well, no. As far as security is concerned, this on the 20th, okay, everything that they should have done on the 6th of January, they trust me, they've covered all bases now. They've extended the evening outer perimeter for blocks, and I think right now it's almost like a police state when you look at how the security is right now at this point in time. So if they don't know who you are, you're not gonna be able to get near that place. So they've got so much security right now, fences up, various outer birds, they've extended it. And right now, no, that on the 20th of January, it's gonna be an inauguration, and they're not even talking about even taking it inside. But right now, it's definitely very secure, and I've had a chance to look at it because I'm in that area. I've had a chance to go up there, and I'm telling you, the place is secure, pretty secure.
So what do you think happened, Marshal Fogg, back on January 6th then?
Well, January 6th, obviously, everybody's asking that question. I mean, why was security so lax? I mean, I've done a lot of these, what you call protection details, and where we've had security, and we've had information. There was a lot of information out that on the 6th was supposed to be a takeover, a coup. I mean, this was what I was hearing way before the 6th. So FBI, Capitol Police, everybody had this information. Now, why did they stand down? Those are the questions that are being asked. Was there a conspiracy? You got one congresswoman, she's saying that she actually saw other congresspeople bringing some of these folks into the Capitol, showing them around the day before, and it was strange.
Time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. Wilmer Leone from Washington, D.C., and Matthew Fogg from Washington, D.C. as well. Thank you both, and have a great year. And gentlemen, and ladies and gentlemen, I should say thank you for tuning in to the News Review program, and take care for now.
Welcome back. The U.S. has imposed new sanctions on China for alleged misdeeds in the South China Sea. Measures put travel bans on an unspecified number of Chinese officials, include executives of state-owned enterprises as well as military officials. Nine Chinese firms were also added to U.S. investment ban. Washington has accused the targeted entities of using coercion against states with rival South China Sea claims. Beijing has slammed the move. It has accused Washington of exploiting its state power to crack down on foreign companies. The sanctions are the latest in a series of measures by outgoing President Donald Trump's administration against China. The measures have escalated tensions between the two sides. Official figures show the UK economy shrank by 2.6% in November as fresh lockdown curbs reduced economic activity. The fall means gross domestic product was 8.5% below its pre-pandemic level in February. That is according to the UK's Office for National Statistics. Services sector has been the worst hit. Economists say the country is still on course for renewed recession, with the economy likely to shrink in the first quarter of this year. Britain has tightened COVID-related restrictions in the past weeks. It is one of the worst affected nations by the pandemic in Europe. Britain has so far recorded over 3.2 million infections, with close to 87,000 deaths. EU lawmakers described the Brexit deal reached last month between Brussels and London as thin. They claim the full consequences of Brexit will not become apparent until the COVID-19 pandemic is brought under control. Jerome Hughes now reports.
EU legislators continue to pore over the details of a trade agreement reached between the 27-nation bloc and Britain on the 24th of December. During a debate on the subject in the European Parliament, the deal was repeatedly branded thin.
I would like to regret a little bit the scope of the agreement. We would, of course, have liked to see more areas covered than the actual deal that is on the table.
Lawmakers highlight how the agreement doesn't say anything about foreign policy, security and defence cooperation. Financial services, environmental standards, and student exchange programs are not mentioned either. Brexit and the EU's handling of various crises, including the current pandemic, clearly illustrate why the bloc needs to undergo fundamental reforms, it has been suggested.
I can estimate what is taking place now, and it is a systemic crisis. And the solution of such a kind of crisis must be revolutionary.
Red tape surrounding imports of food from the EU into the UK is leading to a growing number of empty shelves in British supermarkets. Questions still abound as to whether Brexit might encourage Scotland and Northern Ireland to break away from the UK. EU lawmakers are set to vote on the trade deal at the end of next month or perhaps March, even though it is already in place.
The whole procedure is not satisfactory. This has to be a unique situation, and under no circumstances can this set a precedent for future trade agreements.
If Britain prospers, will other countries opt to leave the EU, rendering the project dead? It is clearly too soon to assess the full economic consequences of Brexit. Some lawmakers have made the point the true scale of the Brexit impact will not become clear until the current pandemic recedes. In this regard, it's claimed, COVID-19 is actually acting as a shield for authorities in Brussels, but perhaps particularly in London. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba vujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The West is obliged to lift the sanctions against Iran immediately. Imam Khamenei used to address the whole nation on the anniversary of the January 8, 1978, which is 19th of Day Uprising, in the presence of thousands of people from Qom in the Husseinia of Imam Khomeini. The US economy is crippled in the true sense of the word. There are tens of millions of unemployed people who suffer from hunger and homelessness. Such is the current situation in the US. The US believes its interests lie in creating instability in the region. They state this openly.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
In the year 1388, which is 2009, the US wished to create instability in Iran, and now this has happened to themselves this year, in 1399, which is 2020. In that year, they wished to do in Iran what has happened in Washington, in particular, the events taking place the day before yesterday. Certain individuals poured into the U.S. Congress, and as a result, they had to evacuate the members of Congress through secret passageways. The front of arrogance keeps questioning Iran's presence in the region. However, the Islamic Republic has a duty to behave in such a way as to strengthen its friends and supporters in the region. Our presence leads to stability. It has been proven that the Islamic Republic's presence in the region helps to eliminate the causes of instability, such as the issue of Daesh, ISIS, in Iraq, various matters in Syria, and the like. However, I do not want to enter into these details now. Those who are involved in these matters are perfectly aware of this. Therefore, our presence in the region is a definite matter, which should and will continue.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
To Allah, all praises to Allah.
pilgrimage again.
The years of war in Syria were difficult years, a time when Syria was the source of bad news. Before the war, Syria was so peaceful that it seemed it was solely created for pilgrims to visit it and seek tranquility, a place of pilgrimage for Muslims and Christians alike. But war killed and destroyed so much of Syria that perhaps it has killed the memories of the past too, the memories held in the minds of those who had seen Syria before the war. War has ended in many Syrian cities, and this means that pilgrims can once more travel to Syria for pilgrimage. With this hope that pilgrims will once again set foot in this land, we will visit the different pilgrimage sites in Syria and see how they have survived the war. Aleppo is Syria's largest and most populated city. It is also among the oldest cities in the world that has linked the East to the West for many centuries. Aleppo is not only a city for Muslims, many Christians also live in this city. In fact, one of Aleppo's tourist attractions is the many beautiful churches in the city. Historically, Aleppo has been famous for its bustling bazaars, its textile industry, its seminaries and universities, and the Aleppo Citadel. These are all what makes Aleppo important and special, and perhaps due to its importance, terrorists tried relentlessly to fully occupy the city during the war, but they were never successful. This enduring war has left Aleppo with scars. In the city, one can find prosperous and bustling neighborhoods next to neighborhoods that have been fully destroyed. For Muslims, especially Shia Muslims, Aleppo is home to two important sites, and it was always visited whenever Muslims travel to the city, Mashhad al-Hussein and Mashhad al-Muhsin. It is said that when the Karbala caravan enters Syria from Iraq, it stayed near a church for one night. A holy father from the church noticed that there is a light shining up to the sky from Imam Hussein's decapitated head. That is why, by paying a hefty sum of money to the soldiers, he managed to borrow the Imam's head for a night. The Holy Father baptizes it and places it on an altar. This altar is now a pilgrimage site. The current building was built around Mashhad al-Hussein. Its architecture resembles that of old churches in the area. Mashhad al-Muhsin is also related to the events of Ashura. It is said that Imam Hussein's wife was pregnant, but the baby was lost after the incident of Ashura. The baby was named Muhsin and was buried in the place that later became known as Mashhad al-Muhsin. These two pilgrimage sites only stand 300 meters apart, but during the war in Aleppo, it was the border between the terrorists and the resistance. The terrorists managed to invade and occupy Mashhad al-Muhsin, but they were never able to set foot in Mashhad al-Hussein, despite all their efforts. Yet this pilgrimage site was severely destroyed by the war. After the war, Shia Muslims reconstructed the site, and now both pilgrimage sites are ready for pilgrims to arrive. In Aleppo, there is a tomb that is said to belong to Zechariah, which is located in the Great Mosque of Aleppo. This mosque was originally constructed in the first century of the Islamic calendar. During the war, the Great Mosque of Aleppo was occupied by terrorist forces, and that is how this historic monument was transformed into this ruin. With the liberation of Aleppo, the restoration of the Great Mosque of Aleppo started. This is why all the original pieces of stone were carefully recovered and meticulously recorded so that they can be put in place during the restoration project. Currently, this mosque is not open to visitors or pilgrims. But after its restoration, this mosque and the tomb will certainly be a destination for pilgrims visiting Aleppo. To see the rest of Syria's pilgrimage sites, one must travel from Aleppo towards Damascus. The first place you will come across is Adra. The tomb of Hujr ibn Adi is located in Adra. Hujr was a close companion of Prophet Muhammad and Imam Ali. He never agreed to swear allegiance to Muawiyah and continuously disclosed his corruption. And that is why Muawiyah ordered him to be killed. When Hujr was apprehended, he was given the chance to use profanity against Imam Ali in order to live, but he did not agree. Hujr, along with his son and a number of his companions, were martyred in the 51st year of the Islamic calendar. In August 2013, terrorists occupied the region and entered the mosque where the tomb of Hujr was located. They destroyed the building and desecrated the grave and claimed to have removed the corpse from its original resting place. But after the liberation of Adra, it became evident that the terrorists had only dug less than a meter deep, and since the body was buried much deeper, the terrorists never actually managed to reach it. This site was later restored by Iraqi defenders of the shrine and other Shia Muslims. This site is ready for pilgrims to visit it. On the outskirts of Damascus lies the Mosque of the Prophet Abel. It is located 45 kilometers from the capital city of Syria. This site has always attracted pilgrims to Syria. After visiting Adra and the Tomb of Hujj, the caravans of pilgrims reached Damascus. Historians claim that the city of Damascus dates back to 3000 BC. It is the oldest city in the world that still stands, and people are still living in it. Damascus is just as sacred to Christians and Jews as it is to Muslims. But for Shia Muslims, Damascus is home to a few sacred sites, and one of them is the Bab el-Saghir Cemetery. It is a large cemetery in the center of Damascus that is the burial site for a number of the Prophet's companions and children of the 12 Imams. The most important of which is the tomb of Kulsum, the daughter of Imam Ali and Hazrat Zahra. Close by is the tomb of Sakina, the daughter of Imam Hussein. These two tombs are located in one chamber, and pilgrims can easily visit both. It is believed that Bab el-Saghir Cemetery is also the burial grounds of Abdullah, the son of Imam Sadiq Fatima Sughra, one of Imam Hussein's daughters, and Abdullah, the son of Imam Sajjad. The graves of nine of the Prophet's companions are also located in this cemetery, the most notable of which is Balal, the first muazzin of Islam. Another companion of the Prophet is Abdullah Ja'far Tayyar, the husband of Lady Zainab. His tomb is adjacent to that of Balal's. According to some historical documents, three of the Prophet's wives, Salameh, Habibah, and Hafsa, are also buried in this cemetery. Fayzeh and Asma, Hazrat Zainab's maids, are also buried here too. Next to Bab el-Saghir Cemetery is a holy place which is believed to be the burial site for the heads of 16 martyrs of Karbala. They belong to Hazrat Abbas and his brothers, Ali Akbar, Imam Hussein's son, Abdullah and Qasim, the sons of Imam Hassan, Habib ibn Mazahir and Hur are among the 16 heads that have been buried here. This area is separated from the cemetery, and inside the shrine, there are 16 turbans that signify the 16 heads. there are other historical narratives that say that there are only three heads belonging to Hazrat Abbas, Ali Akbar, and Habib ibn Mazahir buried here. Bab el-Saghir Cemetery was threatened many times by the terrorists, but with the resistance of the people and the army, it was never occupied. This cemetery remains as one of the major pilgrimage sites of Damascus. The Umayyad Mosque, also known as the Great Mosque of Damascus, is one of the main tourist attractions of Damascus. Parts of this mosque date back 1,400 years. The mosque was built on the site of a Christian basilica, which was the burial ground of John the Baptist. With the construction of the mosque, the burial site of John the Baptist was included inside the building, and Shia Muslims, Sunni Muslims, and Christian pilgrims visited. In the Umayyad Mosque, there are four rectangular halls. One of them is dedicated to Imam Ali, but among Shias, it is known as Ra's al-Hussein. When the Karbala caravan reached Damascus with all of the decapitated heads of the martyrs and the family of the martyrs as captives, they entered the Umayyad Mosque where Yazid was. It is said that the holy head of Imam Hussein was placed where the shrine stands today, known as Ra's al-Hussein. Next to it is a prayer rug and mihrab encased in a glass cubicle, which marks the place where Ali ibn Hussein Zain al-Abidin used to pray while imprisoned in the castle after the Battle of Karbala. The Sayyida Ruqayya Mosque. This mosque is found a short distance from the Umayyad Mosque and contains the grave of Ruqayya, the young daughter of Imam Hussein. After enduring the Battle of Karbala and the torturous journey to Damascus that followed it, Ruqayya reached the Umayyad Mosque. As she could not bear any longer, one night the orphaned three-year-old dreamed of her father and woke up and cried relentlessly. She cried so hard that the soldiers informed Yazid. He ordered the guards to show her the decapitated head of her father Imam to make her quiet. And Yazid was right. The three-year-old Ruqayya was silenced forever. This tragic and moving incident has captivated the hearts of not just Shia pilgrims, but Sunnis and Christians alike. From the very first days of war on Syria, the occupation of Damascus was the terrorists' main agenda. That is why many of the suburbs on the outskirts of the city were occupied or were ceaselessly targeted by the terrorist rockets. One of these suburbs was Daraya, which the terrorists managed to occupy. This suburb was considered as a very strategic base for them as it was located only 5 kilometers from Damascus. It took 5 years of war to liberate Daraya. It is not too hard to guess what the terrorists did to Hazrat Sakina's shrine while they occupied the area. The shrine of Sakina, the daughter of Imam Ali, was completely destroyed when Daraya was occupied by the terrorists. The occupation has razed Daraya to the ground. The town is in ruins, and the Syrian army has not yet allowed it to be open to the public to enter. And devoted Shias are awaiting the time when the Syrian government reopens the gates of Daraya and they can rebuild the shrine. For sure, the main reason pilgrims travel to Syria is to visit the shrine of Hazrat Zainab. The terrorists almost reached it. They only had 100 meters to go, but they never managed to occupy it because of the resistance forces blocked them. The resistance forces included Syrian Sunni Muslims and Shia Muslims from Syria, Lebanon, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, and Iraq. The Iraqi resistance forces could not bear to see the shrine empty of pilgrims, so they brought in their family members from Iraq for pilgrimage during those difficult days. And thus, the shrine of Hazrat Zainab became the central hub for the resistance forces. And the valor of the resistance in defending the shrine inspired resistance forces across Syria. Now pilgrims can visit the shrine of Hazrat Zainab in absolute safety and security.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How
much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A warm welcome to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. This program is coming to you from Iran, and you can download it from our website, IRIB English Radio. Just simply search Bookshelf. That's the easiest way of accessing our program or the episodes in the archives. Well, these days belong to Lady Fatima, the daughter of the Holy Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him and his holy family. 2 days from now, we're going to have the martyrdom of Fatima al-Zahra, and these are very sad days. And we decided to dedicate this episode to this lady, very important figure in the history of Islam. There is a very nice part in the book House of Sorrows, The Life of Sayyida Fatima al-Zahra and Her Grief, written by Sheikh Abbas al-Ghumi, and we deemed it very fit and suitable to a kind of introduction as a background to our program, Bookshelf. Well, every year millions of Muslims cry for Fatima al-Zahra. There are a multitude of gatherings, both commemorations and mourning ceremonies in her memory. There are observances of praise, joy, and honor for her, in which her noble characteristics are remembered, while Muslims also hold rituals of lamentation, where they recount in vivid detail the painful events of Islamic history which led to her intense grief and eventual martyrdom. The faithful even go to the extent of invoking Almighty Allah to deprive those who hurt her from His mercy and blessings. Despite everything which is recalled on the pulpits throughout the world and the articles and booklets which have been published so far about this great woman, the true history of her short life and the salient features of her personality are still unknown. However, still, with the little that the Muslims know about her, they still accept Fatima, her majesty and greatness, wholeheartedly. The sphere of influence of Fatima al-Zahra is extensive, and she not only appeals and is a person of reverence for the Muslim community and whom only Muslim authors write about, rather her character, personality and visage actually transcend religion and the Muslim sphere. Well, I hope you get the point about how important this woman is in Islam, not only in early history of Islam, but also for the centuries to come. Let's end this section and take a short break.
Yeah.
to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And we were introducing the book, The House of Sorrows, The Life of Sayyida Fatima al-Zahra and Her Grief, written by Sheikh Abbas Qumi. And now we are going to introduce the translator. This book has been translated by Ijaz Ali Turab Hussain Bujwala. And you can easily download it from al-islam.org. It's a translation of Baitul Ahsan fi Masa'iba Sayyidatun Niswan. So, we already introduced the author and also the translation publication and also the translator. And now is the time for a little background which is provided by the publisher. This book, House of Sorrows, in fact, in short, is the first ever book in English to detail the last 6 months of the life of the only daughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his holy family. Well, this book focuses on the status of Lady Fatima from Quranic verses and traditions and delves into the events immediately preceding the death of Prophet Muhammad. There are a number of events discussed in this text, such as Saqifah, the taking of Farak, and then in vivid words goes through the last months of her life. Be prepared to shed tears as you read the heart-wrenching events of what happened to Az-Zahra, as recounted and narrated in the major books of the Ahl Sunnah and the Shia. We're going to read a very short excerpt from this book, and we hope that you enjoy it, in fact, in the next part of this program, Bookshelf.
شمسا تهدي البشرية لحياة القرب الأبدي يا قبلة عزم الأحرار في قلب محمد تلهمنا كل الإصرار وعلي يشهد يا قبلة عزم الأحرار في قلب محمد تلهمنا كل الإصرار وعلي يشهد يا روح الله يا سر الله يا روح الله يا سر الله يا آية كل الأزمان.
Back to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. We were introducing the book House of